Is it possible to fall in love in one day?
I did.
It was like this for you and Jack?
No, it was another fella. I fell in love in a day. It lasted a week. But what a week. Then I met Jack. Oh, took months to figure it out with him.
Well, then maybe I should slow down. Catch my breath. Not let this thing get out of control. Nah.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, going to aerobics class.
And that will be very relevant, as you will learn, as we delve into Star Trek's underexplored relationships.
What do we mean by underexplored relationships here at Star Trek, Cam?
Okay, well, this is my topic, and I was doing my rewatch of Enterprise, and, you know, I think anyone who's watched Enterprise knows that show very much focuses on Archer, T'Pol, and Trip, and often at the expense of the supporting cast, who we've talked about in other past podcast episodes. And
Porthos, what could have been.
Yeah, exactly. And so I really felt like the show needed more Porthos to be a better show. But no, what really happened was I was watching an episode, and I'm going to touch on it later when we get into actually talking about Enterprise, but where two characters were sharing a lot of time together, and I thought the scenes were really fantastic.
And yet the writers never thought to go back to that well.
Exactly.
Once again. Yeah.
And so then I began to wonder, you know, a lot of these shows would often shortchange characters who may have been really interesting together, and some we've talked about at various points over the last several years of doing this podcast where we said, hey, those two characters had a lot of chemistry in that scene. Why did they never do anything with that? And so I thought it'd be fun to do an actual episode focused around looking at some of these combinations and maybe, you know, maybe at some point tossing off some fun ones too or something.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. So why don't we start right off the bat with the original series, Cam?
Yeah.
What is like one of those unrealized, underexplored relationships that you think would have been a little bit more fun, or I guess there's more fruit to grow there?
Right. Well, I mean, TOS, like Enterprise, obviously focused really just on the triumvirate.
Yeah.
You know, Scotty got a lot to do as well. But for the most part, it's your Spock, Bones, Kirk dynamic. And so it really becomes a game of like, well, which of the supporting cast who was ignored a lot would you like to see more of? I felt like Chekhov is used a fair amount, but the character who's always bugged me, and this is actually tied into the movies as well, as Uhura. Because when you get to those movies, Uhura has nothing to do other than like a one scene kind of moment.
Yeah, isn't it bizarre that Chekhov has way more to do in every single movie than Uhura does at any single point?
He even does on the show at a certain point as well.
Yeah.
Whereas like I feel like Uhura is such an icon that I think it would have been great to do more with her. And so I was batting back and forth, like, look, you see early on that there's the sort of the weird Uhura Spock thing going on in like the Man Trap, as well as Charlie X, where she's kind of trolling him to a certain degree. And there seems to be a bit of a flirtation. But we see then Christine Chappell comes on, and that's where Spock's attention goes, not Uhura. So I was like, kind of decide, and I'd actually like your input too, like, what would you have liked to have seen more? You know, Uhura being, you know, playful with Spock more throughout the series and pairing those characters off, as you see in the Kelvinverse, which I think worked really well in the Kelvinverse.
Yeah, I agree.
Or, you know, we saw in Star Trek V, no one's favorite Star Trek film, but you see that they pair off Scotty and Uhura, and they have a certain playful relationship as well, which Nichelle Nichols has said was in no way romantic, which I thought was interesting. That's not really the vibe I got from that scene, or from their scenes, but...
Yeah, I mean, I can understand there's chemistry. It doesn't necessarily have to go beyond the kind of platonic. So,
but it does feel so the way they're portrayed in that episode.
Just
that
for
film.
Listeners, yeah. Though, like to clarify, your pitch here is a further exploration of the Spock and Uhura relationship,
or the Scotty and Uhura. Because I think you
have to pick one.
Well, that's why I wanted your input, though. Like, which one do you think would have serviced the show better? Because I think to say Spock, That's the one where there's the most fodder within the show, right? But you're also then giving Spock even more to do when he's already a hugely prominent character, so, whereas Scotty doesn't have those types of dynamics.
I have some backup relationships in case you stole any of mine.
Me too.
And you did steal my first one here. I'll have to say, you're asking about underexplored relationships.
Mm-hmm.
The Scotty Uhura dynamic is not anything that ever popped to mm-hmm. me, so I would absolutely 100% say the Spock and Uhura dynamic, because... I mean, you can point to an episode like Who Mourns for Adonai with regards to that scene in which Spock's really pushing Uhura to do her best.
One of the all-time scenes.
Yeah, she's repairing a console, and Spock's like, you're the best one, most qualified to do this. You can get it done. So I would say it's so weird thinking of... you bring up a good point with regards to the films.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think about the great Uhura moments in the films.
Yeah.
What is the most, I guess... recognizable, iconic Uhura moment within the film's camp?
Boy, I mean...
It's the fan dancing, is it not?
The fan dancing
in Five?
That's
what all the fans are going to point to.
Maybe some of the dinner table stuff in Star Trek VI?
No.
The fan table's the one everyone's going to shout.
If you ask what everyone's going to talk about, it's the fan dancing, which isn't... Is that really Uhura at her best?
Right.
You know, like, I'd rather much see her... being like super competent as an officer of Starfleet versus a real great dancer.
It does bug me, though, that you see in the original series, they're pairing her off with Spock early on, and they're trying to build up this chemistry between these two. So obviously that is their idea early on, that they want to have these two kind of playfully, you know, kind of jabbing at each other.
Yeah.
And it's like, I wonder what the reasons were behind the scenes for dropping that.
Do you know, for dropping that? Okay, well... Yeah. You can look behind the scenes and look, by season 3, it's all over the place with regards to the writing.
Sure.
I can understand that. And remember even Nichelle Nichols was talking about how she wanted to leave the show?
Yeah.
And actually took like MLK to push her to stay on?
Yeah.
I just wonder if maybe the writers were looking at a bit of an aloofness from the actress and they're like, well, you know what? We just want to focus on the three dudes.
And right.
I mean, it's 1960s TV. I guess you can kind of understand that at the time.
And it's not necessarily surprising either that they have Chapel coming in, who's the blonde Caucasian woman who's getting the more love interest of Spock type material. So that's also not at all surprising in the 60s.
But I'm curious, try to sell me a little bit on your Scotty Uhura pitch, because that never jumped out to me.
Right. Well, you don't see any real evidence of it in the show, right? But you do get...
Yeah, great you're not joking when you say this is an underexplored relationship,
right.
Cam.
It's more in the sense in that you see in Star Trek V, they're really pairing these two off as really good friends, maybe more, and that they seem very close. And they are two characters who, when you get to the original series,
Scotty, I think you said Spock at the beginning. That's why I was
confused. Did as well. I was trying to determine which one I thought would have serviced the show better.
Oh, no. You said that that Nichelle Nichols had referenced that there's no romantic chemistry.
Oh, did I say that? I was referring to Scotty.
Okay.
So,
gotcha.
Sorry, that's for Star Trek V. Yeah. And so, you know, I was thinking of Star Trek V, where you have these two characters who... It really seemed like Shatner and his writers really wanted to play those two up as like a pair in that movie. And so I then began to kind of reverse engineer and go like, would the original series have benefited from having these two kind of paired off, bringing something out of each other on the show as well?
I mean, they both have red uniforms. Mm-hmm. There could have been a lot more of that back and forth. But I mean, if our thesis here is underexplored relationships, there was never anything explored in the first place.
Yeah.
So I'd have to nix that. And I really... The thing that pops out to me from Star Trek V is not the Scotty Uhura dynamic, personally.
Right. It's the fan dance?
Yeah. Oh, obviously. Yeah. So, for me, you know what? If you went with Spock, I'm going to go with Kirk. And, like, what are some of those underexplored relationships? And I think the one that you can kind of... we've discussed it on the show before about, like, how awful it turned out to be. But the Kirk and Janice Rand relationship.
Yeah.
In that, like, it was a great relationship. What was awful is what happened to the actress behind the scenes where she was sexually assaulted and ended up leaving the series relatively early on.
Yeah, I think 8 episodes she did.
But the thing is that there's so much chemistry between the two.
Right.
And there's interesting conflict in that, like, Kirk was a consummate professional,
mm-hmm.
and he had a really good relationship with a character who, I mean, look, you're trying to sell it to 1960s audiences, you're going to find an attractive woman who, you know, thinks that it's a bodacious beau who's, you know, the leading man here.
Sure.
So I'm like, okay, sure, why not? But for whatever reason, I mean, it still worked. I like that dynamic, and I like the fact that Kirk kept it professional at all times. And
there is a romantic tension there.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like the two actors actually have really strong chemistry, and there is that sort of sense of, like, you know, boy, maybe in a different life they would be able to pursue this, but they can't because of their duty to Starfleet and their, obviously, job titles. But I like that tension is there for the two of them, and that they manage to explore that in ways that aren't skeevy. Like, she's very good at reading him to a degree, and I like that he has, like, moments in Balance of Terror where he's actually able to kind of tell her his concerns or whatever. Like, it doesn't feel, like, overly salacious or anything. It feels like two people that actually have a lot of compassion for and respect for each other, but there is that tension.
Are you concerned that it could have potentially gotten skeevy beyond episode 8, though? I mean, like, she ended up leaving early on.
Yeah.
I'm just, the thing is, when you think there's, like, almost 80 episodes that they could have potentially appeared in, I also wonder about, by season 3, if they're, like, I wonder if the fact that 8 episodes, it was a good time to explore with them, and then it could have just been like, oh man, what are they doing with these two characters? This is not cool.
Well, I think that is a bit of the problem, is that they had this fundamentally flawed problem where they bring in this actress to play this could-be love interest to Kirk. You know, this woman that he obviously has eyes for to a certain degree, and then it becomes tough to bring in other potential love interests into the show. And, you know, there's not a ton of them in the first two seasons of Star Trek, but it is tough to bring them in and have audiences forget about Janice Rand. Like, I think because Janice Rand's there a lot, audience loyalty is a little more on her side. It's kind of like the problem they ran into with Ethan Hunt in the Mission Impossibles, where audiences didn't seem to forget that he was married. And so, you know, you had like an Ilsa Faust character coming in, and people were like, hold on now, Ethan Hunt's married.
He was.
He was, for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can tell that the writers essentially are like, this is a problem we have to work around.
Well, we're doing a Star Trek podcast, he was divorced by the time that Mission Impossible movie came around. I don't really know if the writers were, you know, fretting.
They were. I listened to interviews with Christopher McQuarrie, and he said he was very much concerned about that, because that was the number one thing they heard the most about, was people saying, you know, his wife is still around.
His ex-wife, you mean?
Did they ever acknowledge they were divorced?
Yeah. She's married in the latest movie.
In the latest one, but he's talking about from going to 5 into 6.
Okay, again, Star Trek podcast. I had no issues with that, because to me it was very clear that these characters were no longer married. Right. But anyway.
But it's a similar problem with Star Trek, in the sense I feel like if you have Janice Rand there, the audience likes her a lot. Like, she's a very likable character, and so they don't necessarily want to see Kirk off with, you know, a potential love interest. Like, Edith Keeler comes around in City on the Edge of Forever. Are people like, excuse me, Janice Rand?
And that could have been a potential issue there. Are you disappointed by, I guess, the lack of what they had to do together in the films, though? I mean, did they even share any dialogue?
Not that I recall. I think there was maybe a line, but...
Like exposition?
Exactly, that sort of thing.
Was that just a huge lost opportunity, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I don't know that anything was going to come of it. When they were transitioning Star Trek into the movies, I don't think they were like, we've got to give Janice Rand more to do. I think it was more like, get her in for a cameo.
No, but in your opinion, though.
In my opinion? I mean, I know I probably should be like, no, I want to see that character explored more. But I feel like so much time had gone by in terms of the series and the adventures those characters had gone on without her, that I was kind of okay with it.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't feel really robbed not seeing her presented as suddenly, like, one of the supporting stars of the movie or anything.
There's an offhanded remark in, I think it was Into Darkness, and I forget if it was with regards to Janice Rand or Christine Chappell, but it was implied very much that Kirk and Chappell had a bit of a fling, which really, I don't know, grates on me. Amongst the many problems with Star Trek Into Darkness, it's just like, I never needed to hear that,
right,
in my opinion there. Okay, so Kim, why don't we jump into Star Trek: The Next Generation here? I'll take it away here. And I alluded to it at the start of the episode, but the Crusher Troy friendship, I think this one was very much underexplored here. Like, okay, we saw them exercise together.
Sure.
We saw them.
That is what you were referencing in your opening there.
Exactly.
We're not going to leave it half an hour like our Joe Piscopo reference from a couple episodes ago.
It was so worth it. But we also saw them in, say, Sub Rosa when they were talking about Crusher's grandmother's erotic journal.
Right.
But it very much seemed like a conversation that you would have with a friend. I know you and I have had that conversation about your grandmother's erotic journal.
Which journal? The first, the second, the third?
The fourth volume.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's also, the only other real strong moment that sticks out is like in Insurrection when they're talking about their boobs firming up.
Right.
And it's like, is this the best that you can give two women? It like, really? Like, this is all you think that they would ever talk about? They have such a great chemistry together as well. And it was funny because you hear from the writers, like sometimes, I forget which writer had said it, but and it may have been on a Blu-ray or at a convention, I forget. But like, yeah, maybe we wrote this scene for those two characters because we heard the actresses were fighting and we wanted them to reconcile.
Right.
But the actresses were good friends.
Yeah.
We've seen Gates McFadden and Marina Sirtis. They actually got into it in 2017 in Las Vegas.
Right.
It was just like a squabble live on stage about actors in the UK versus young actors in Los Angeles. And you could tell it was friends fighting.
It was kind of uncomfortable. And I think it would have been fine enough, except a lot of the audience had paid specifically just for that panel.
Yeah, I think like $50 a ticket or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Which was a little that's a heck of a way to wrap up a $50 panel.
Yeah. But like the fact of the matter is like the actresses clearly had chemistry. I think there's so much more to
I think that whole cast had chemistry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But think about it. I mean, the show is a bit of a sausage fest though.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have like two women, there weren't really that many moments where they weren't really exchanging just exposition.
Right.
But even if they were, they both have blue uniforms.
Yeah.
Why not talk about the sciences, the medical fields, like that sort of stuff? Like make them sound good at their jobs together and like just kind of bolstering each other.
Right.
And we just didn't get much outside of those few moments that I mentioned. And but the thing is like the aerobics class, that's one of the like most iconic, you know, moments. We're talking about the episode Second Chances with Tom Riker returning. And I think that's like a great moment of friendship. Like one of the most, you know, notable that we ever saw in Star Trek The Next Generation. How come we weren't having more of those, you know,
right,
throughout the series?
Yeah, well, it's an excellent question. It's one of those interesting cases where, like, when I was looking at TNG for underexplored relationships, I actually found TNG maybe the hardest because I actually think TNG was pretty good at pairing off characters.
I agree.
In different orders. Like, I actually felt like the show did a really good job. But you're right. Like, I definitely had those two of your main cast as, like, the two that you felt the most robbed by. But I don't know if it was basically an almost all-male writing staff for the most part in
for
TNG.
The most part, yeah.
You know, just being like, I don't know how to write female dialogue. You know, there's that Seinfeld episode where, you know, they're writing their pilot and they're like, that's why we don't write female characters, because they could never figure out what Elaine was thinking.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if it's that sort of lazy thing where they're just like, I don't know what these two women would say to each other. So what do they usually talk about? It's usually about like a love interest or something like that.
And they were really bad at, you know, like following the Bechdel test.
Yeah. I mean, because like, I think there's also a time where they hang out and talk about one of Deanna's love interests too,
yeah,
you know, and you're like, okay, sure, I guess. I mean, I understand the function within the story as to why you do that, because Deanna's maybe not going to talk to Geordi about such things. Like,
no one would talk to Geordi about relationships, Cam.
Crusher's a good sounding board there to have the two of them talk about these characters.
Well, but okay, and let's think about it. Like, Deanna would likely not talk to Riker, although she has before.
Yeah.
She's not going to talk to Geordi.
Right.
What experience does Data have?
Yeah.
She's not going to talk to Wesley.
Right.
So it's pretty much up to, like, Worf and Picard. So
the masters of love.
Yeah. And so I guess I can kind of give the writers a pass.
Yeah.
There.
Like, I understand why they did it.
Yeah.
But I think the thing for me is, like, they should have actually explored those two more, because they're both, like, in the medical field. Like, why not have these two characters just sharing notes, like, dealing with a case?
Having exactly,
having an episode built around these two as, like, professionals. I actually think that could have been a really good episode.
I'm totally down with you there. So who's on your list here for Star Trek Next Generation? Because this was, I agree with you, like they really explored relationships here. So what was maybe kind of an unexplored one in your opinion?
Okay, so when it came to the main cast, yours was the only one on my list. But I thought
you stole one from me. I steal one from
that's
you.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But I, you know, was thinking about the episode The Next Phase and pairing up Geordi and Ro Laren.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is a pair I would have never thought as interesting. If I were in that, you know, session where the writer comes in and pitches that episode, I'm kind of like, really? Those two? Should we maybe swap out someone else? Like, what about, you know, Ro Laren and Worf or something? They're both kind of outsider aliens
well,
or something.
I can understand Ro for this episode. Why do you think it is that the writers picked Geordi to do this one?
I don't know. Yeah. And that's what's really interesting. Maybe because he has so much technical know-how, he's able to vocalize a lot of what could be going on in, you know, in this whole problem where they've, you know, are invisible to everyone. Like, that could be it.
Yep.
Like, Worf's not going to be spouting out techno-babble as to what could be possible problem solvers. So Geordi makes sense in that regard. But I actually thought these two characters had a lot of chemistry together. And they're both characters who could be seen as quite aloof. Geordi probably more so. Ro Laren's a little more fiery than Geordi. But I like the idea of these two characters who often feel like outsiders from the general group working together to overcome a problem. And it's the type of combinations like that that I wish they'd done more of. I think of also characters like Yar. You know, there are other characters they could have paired off in interesting ideas. But I think this is the one that really jumps to me is like, we really got to see it presented incredibly well in The Next Phase. So like, we have proof it works, whereas the other ones are more theoretical.
Well, and just there's a moment that sticks out to me when they're kind of debating like their own philosophies and where it's very clear that Ro is a lot more spiritual than Geordi is. With,
right.
You know, is this really death?
Mm-hmm.
And it's those kinds of moments in Star Trek The Next Generation, at least, that I wish we had more of.
Yeah.
And the fact that it worked here, you'd hope that they would have paired the actors up more. Let's be honest, though. I think the writers had a tough time nailing down Michelle Forbes. Just, like, she seemed a little bit more indifferent towards the franchise than maybe the writers had hoped.
Right.
So I would have liked to have explored that relationship further. I just don't know if there are too many opportunities beyond, I don't know, Rascals.
So, right. Yeah. It is interesting to me, though, that, like, Ro Laren was such a rich character that they almost didn't see her, like, this embarrassment of riches they had to pair off with other characters just to see what would happen.
Yeah.
Like, I would have loved to have seen her and Worf paired off as, like, what happens when you have these two outsider aliens? You know, kind of like, they are kind of the outsiders on the ship to a certain degree. Like, how do they feel?
Just be thankful we got to see Ro and Guinan jumping on a bed in Rascals.
Well, so, I am every day.
There you go. Let's talk about Deep Space Nine now, because this is one that there's, what, like 24 main and recurring characters that are rich and worthy of further exploration. So this one is kind of an interesting one, and I did want to nail it down to the main cast, but I'll throw it back to you first. You tell me what is one of the relationships that you think was worthy of more exploration on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, I really was playing around with this one because
there's so many different possibilities, right?
So many, but DS9, you know, was really good too about trying different combinations. So it became more like, well, which ones worked maybe for an episode that you could have done more with? And actually, I picked one I don't think you would have picked. It's actually kind of an odd one.
It'd be funny if we picked the same one, but go for it.
And I was thinking of Bashir and Jake Sisko.
Oh, no, you're correct. I never would have picked that one.
I feel like no one listening to this was like, boy, those are two characters I want to spend more time with. But
don't you think... go ahead.
No, well, what I really liked about this pairing is, and this is tied to the episode Nor the Battle for the Strong, where Jake goes with Bashir into a battlefield and ends up being horrified by what he's seeing. And Bashir takes this very like paternal, like, or even maybe like big brother like stance when dealing with Jake. And is very much like teaching him how to operate and how to conduct himself in this environment. And I began to think about this episode, and in many ways, we're seeing Jake is what Bashir was when he joined the show. He's kind of an annoying young guy who's like, I'm going in to find adventure. And we're now seeing kind of the older, wiser Bashir having to almost deal with a younger version of himself.
This is not an episode that actually would have worked in, say, season 1 or 2 of Deep Space
It would have been
Nine.
A very different episode.
Yeah.
Also, you'd be like, why did they bring Jake into a war zone at like, the age of 8?
Yeah, exactly.
When he's trying to be a reporter.
Yeah. No, this is, again, like not an episode that I would immediately spring to mind.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you think they would have been able to do with like further adventures between the two? Like, I think it would have had to be, you know, space station-based stuff.
Agreed, yeah.
And it could have been awkward because recall that both Jake and Bashir dated Leeta. Like, do you think that would have been awkward between the two of them?
Wait, Jake dated Lita?
I thought Jake had made inquiries about Lita. Or am I misremembering?
He had a Dabo girlfriend when he was younger.
Was it a different Dabo girl?
Yeah, there was a different Dabo girl.
Because
then
I was thinking about it. It is a little awkward because then his best friend's father ends up marrying his ex. I must be wrong.
It's a very incestuous station.
Yeah, that's true. You know, there's only so many people that live there. Right. So. Okay. My apologies.
But no, it's to me, I think you're right. There are limitations in how are you going to pair these two up? But also, Sirach Lofton, it's pretty well known, was the least used regular cast member in the history of Star Trek, where he was, absent from countless episodes. Mm-hmm. And so I think there could have been ways to work in, you could easily write something in that he's helping as a medic or something, somehow bring him into the sphere of Julian Bashir on the ship, or sorry, on the station. I'm not saying the medic is the best idea, but I'm saying there's ways to write, that these characters are somehow occupying the same space. Yeah. Maybe during the Dominion War, maybe they wind up on a ship at some point together. I'm not saying I want this to be a 3-season arc of these two characters' friendships, O'Brien and Bashir, but I'm saying find a couple episodes here or there to pair these two off, just to have the idea of, Jake so often is either looking at Nog, who's his peer, or his dad, who's his dad.
Yep.
Whereas I think it would have been interesting to see him paired off with someone who is kind of like a big brother type, who has that sort of youthful energy and outlook, but sort of has the experience to actually impart some wisdom in a way that doesn't feel with Sisko. Again, it's your dad giving you advice.
I'm honestly just kind of waiting for entire, acts devoted to Bashir giving Jake advice about the ladies.
You're just thinking of Riker and Wesley Crusher, aren't you?
Much, that would have been entertaining.
Which scene would have been better, though? Would it have competed with Riker giving Wesley advice?
Well, it, of course, would have been during a racquetball game in the hall suite. So, it would have been, No, I how can you really beat the Dauphin?
You can't.
Yeah,
as an episode or for that scene.
Exactly, yeah.
But I think also it would have worked really well just because physically, Sirach Lofton and Siddiq Al-Fadel have a similar stature and build. It actually looks good to have these two characters together. They feel like they belong.
Certainly,
and would work together on screen.
You'd have to capture Sirach Lofton at the right time of his growth spurt as a young man, because I think by the end of the series he was towering over every single actor.
Yeah. Although Siddiq Al-Fadel is also a very tall man.
Yeah.
But I think, obviously this doesn't work in seasons one or two.
Sure.
It's kind of isn't Bashir busy?
And isn't Jake 11?
Yeah, exactly. So. Bashir's hired to babysit for an episode.
That I actually would watch that. In season one,
right?
I would totally watch that episode. Yeah. And then Nog pops in through the Jefferies tube.
Yeah.
That would have been pretty fun.
It would have been adventures in babysitting all over again.
Yeah, Okay, so we're agreed.
I guess that makes Bashir the Elizabeth Shue of the story.
Call him Elizabeth Bashir Shue.
That joke just... Amazing.
Anyway, so my pick here for Deep Space Nine is, if you go to the episode Hippocratic Oath, this is episode 3 of season 4, and we're still kind of establishing which role Worf is going to have on the station here. And so we have the Worf and Odo dynamic.
Okay, that is on my list. That was my backup.
Because this one, it's kind of uncomfortable in that, Worf looks like a total idiot.
Yes.
In that he's coming on to a strange station. He doesn't know the dynamic. He doesn't know how security operates here, but he's going to take it upon himself to become, Inspector Worf all of a sudden.
Right.
Whereas if you watch Star Trek The Next Generation, he was more the guy behind the tactical station. Yes, he would be the one who would escort people from the transporter room to the brig.
Right.
But he wasn't a detective like we got to see what Odo do throughout the series. So obviously they established that, look, Worf, you're not in charge of security, but
it's also a very volatile political situation. And, I think Odo's really good at navigating that sort of terrain.
Yeah.
Whereas Worf, he might kill one of the rulers.
Very true.
He's done it before, and he'll do it again.
Multiple times throughout the run of the series. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, can you really imagine or point to any other, Worf-Odo encounters?
I actually have a note on that.
Okay.
And then my note literally says, initial headbutting and then double dates. Because we do see, like, Worf and Jadzia out with Odo and Kira.
Yeah, that's when you get like, to, like season six. Oh, yeah, yeah, I guess it would have been season six. Yeah.
Yeah, because obviously, yeah, Ezri comes in season seven. But yeah.
You can really tell that that scene landed with the audiences.
Well, I mean, I like the idea of double dates on Star Trek. I actually think that's really fun. I wish they'd been able to do that more in other series, maybe, but you obviously don't have a lot of couples.
The Jake and Nog double date, that was one of the most uncomfortable double dates I've ever seen on TV, that's awful.
Yeah. But a lot of the time, you're not going to have two characters in steady relationships on the show, because writers don't like that as much.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, the only time that really jumps out to me is like Let He Who Is Without Sin, where you have Bashir and Lita, as well as Worf and Dax.
Where's Jake?
Yeah. Oh, he's the cabana boy.
Yeah.
But I mean, yeah, I actually think the Odo Worf thing is really interesting. I wonder if, because I'm with a bunch of these, I'm trying to wrap my head around why you wouldn't do it.
They're both outsider characters.
They are.
I'm wondering if maybe the writers saw that they had too much of the same worldview.
Yeah.
So how can you really get much more conflict other than what you got out of Hippocratic Oath, where it's like, hey, don't tread on me, buddy.
They're also very, like, stubborn and aloof characters, and I just wonder if you pair those two off, what it takes for them to really communicate.
And would the audiences actually grow frustrated with the dynamic between them? Here's my pitch, though. Let's say there was an investigation going on the station that Odo was conducting, and it involved some Klingon, you know, politics. Maybe you can say, hey, Worf, I need your help on this. Like, that would have been a little interesting. And then by the end of the episode, Worf probably would have killed a couple Klingons, because that's just kind of what Worf does there.
You know what also might have worked, actually? When you have Worf come onto the station, and he's really uncomfortable, and he's like living on the Defiant, you could have had a bit of maybe a B story built around how Odo is the only one that really understands what Worf is going through, because Odo is very solitary as well.
Yeah.
I think you could have had something there.
Could they have been roommates with like...
Oh, boy.
Worf in the Defiant bunk bed, and then the bucket on the top bunk.
It actually has its own bunk.
Yeah. I would have watched that that Odd Couple episode myself.
Yeah, I think that could have been really interesting. Who's the messy one, and who's the clean one?
I would say... Well, that's a very good question. I would say Worf's the messy one. Is that Oscar or Felix? I don't know.
Oh,
I think Oscar's the messy one.
I think so.
So Worf is Oscar, Odo is Felix.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, like, really, what does Odo have to clean up?
Not much, but he does seem very particular about where things are.
Yeah.
So I could see him... Although, you know, Worf kind of seems like that, too. I'm just picturing
Worf in Genesis when he rips his bed to pieces and, like, sleeps on, like, foam.
Right.
24th century memory foam.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, are you into Casper mattresses, Cam?
Oh, I love my Casper mattress. Because we have a deal for you. Yeah, yeah.
No, just kidding. We don't. Yeah, so...
We wish we had a deal with Casper mattresses.
Yes. Cam, why don't we jump over to Voyager? What would be kind of an underexplored relationship on that Defiant series that you think could bear more fruit?
This is one we actually talked about fairly recently. And it was actually, I believe, to the best of my memory, is when we were talking about the Year of Hell, and they paired off Seven and Tuvok for scenes where they were trying to deactivate a bomb. And we talked during that episode, like, why do they not pair these two off? Like, it feels like Tuvok is a character that could actually communicate with Seven. He has a similar demeanor as she does, but is also, I think, more open to what humanity represents. It's an outsider, essentially, recommending kind of the appeals of humanity to her, possibly.
I thought long and hard about this one as well. Yeah. And I just wonder if their concern was that they really wanted Janeway to be her mentor. So it would just be kind of taken away from that. And let's be honest, like, Tuvok, he just did not have much to do on the series. And
it would have given him something to do.
It would have given him something to do, but I don't think the writers were all that interested in giving him much to do. And whatever that he could have done, it's stuff that the writers were already giving Janeway to do. I 100% agree with you, Cam. This relationship was on my list because we saw it work so well on Year of Hell.
Right.
So it was just such a bummer that we never really got to explore that. Do you remember in The Raven where Tuvok and Seven of Nine actually got to face off and like throw down and fight each other?
Right.
That was even just like a fun fight sequence for Star Trek, which we mock the Star Trek fight sequences.
Yes, of course.
Quite a bit. Is it bizarre that it took 51 years until Star Trek Discovery premiered and We did not get an embarrassingly bad fight choreography.
There's a couple good moments in DS9. A couple.
Look,
I'm thinking of like Worf and the Jem'Hadar, or even like Kira and Damar isn't terrible.
I would say watching Kirk take on an Andorian and journey to Babel.
Where that one's amazing. I actually really love that.
Where he's literally doing like ninja kicks and like flying off the wall. That one's pretty awesome.
What I actually love about the original series fight scenes is that you will never see another fight scene like them. Like, they're weird, but they are so memorable because no one staged fight choreography like that, really, even in movies.
Was it actually staged? Or I get the sense.
I think
sense
the actors were improvising a lot of it.
I think they were improvising, though.
Yeah, and that's what makes it really interesting, especially the Journey to Babel one, which you referenced, because it's crazy when it just opens with like him like jumping off the wall on top of the Andorian.
Yeah,
it's great. But
back to Tuvok.
Tuvok so dull that we're even like sinking away from him during conversation about him. But no, like I feel like Tuvok. I mean, he's a character. He's definitely near the bottom of my list for my favorite Voyager characters, and I genuinely think it's because the relationships with him are so uninteresting. Yeah, you get some nice stuff with like him and Janeway.
Neelix?
The Neelix stuff I'm not a fan of at all. I find it kind of annoying. And other than that, you just don't get a lot. Whereas I think this would have actually been an opportunity to maybe help the character a lot.
I agree, yeah.
And we did see, you know, we should say, I think it's actually maybe should have been mentioned up front. We saw that he was actually an interesting mentor character for Kes. And that he was the one who could kind of help her
work telepathy
through.
Telepathy.
Yeah, he could help her work through her powers. So we saw that dynamic works. And I wonder if it was more like they just didn't want to repeat the same thing. But it did work. And I think with Seven, you would have had a different angle to take. It wouldn't feel like repeats of him talking to her about how to deal with her Borg powers. So, because I don't know that Tuvok's the guy to give that advice.
That's true.
But I think
Maybe after Unimatrix Zero, he could have helped her out. Yeah.
I just think it would have been really interesting because philosophically, you know, Tuvok is a very stiff Vulcan character who believes very much in the tenets of being a Vulcan. But why does he choose to surround himself but with humans? And I think that would have been an interesting dynamic to talk about when it came to Seven, because here's Seven, this character who comes from the Borg and, you know, is very uneasy around humans, but like he could talk to her about why, because we never really understood why is Tuvok here. I think he could have actually voiced actually the reasons why he likes being on Voyager.
One of my favorite little throwaway lines that we ever got with regards to Tuvok was in Flashback, where it's revealed that Tuvok was in Starfleet and then he took like a 60-year-long sabbatical.
Right.
And then he went back to Starfleet.
Yeah.
And then that's when he, you know, has that relationship with Janeway that they form and it goes from there. And I thought it would have been interesting to kind of explore more of his reasoning behind leaving Starfleet and then coming back.
Yeah.
There's obviously a reason why he came back. I think the implication was is like he was done being a father at that point.
Right.
And, you know, but for me, Star Trek Voyager, here's one that they really actually tried going with early on in the series, and then they kind of dropped, and I was bummed out because I did like the chemistry between one Harry Kim and one B'Elanna Torres, where recall that she's always calling him Starfleet.
Right.
They're both too young, you know, like Harry's got no experience, and then B'Elanna does not want to be on this ship following orders from this crew, and it was just an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, like a Keener versus someone who's, you know, a bit of a delinquent on the ship. Yeah.
And seeing them go back and forth, and they legit, like, had a good back and forth between each other. I think, like, halfway through season one, they're like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
And, like, it just
Although they did ended, that with B'Elanna a lot.
Which is very much a bummer. But I even think, like, if you see the relationship, you know, unfortunately, more and more, like, B'Elanna's character was defined more by her relationship with Tom than anything else. I still think it would have been a great dynamic if you have kind of like the best friend and the wife or, you know, fiance hanging out, having that dynamic. I could imagine them complaining about Tom all the time, you know, like, you know, yeah, I got to go another Captain Proton sort of thing now. Sorry about it.
Or even having B'Elanna and Harry Kim kind of turning on Tom, like having like fun scenes like that where they're ridiculing him.
Like, I think there would have been like good back and forth dynamic between the two of them.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and they all like each other, you know, it would never be mean spirited when I say they're turning on each other, but more just like playful dynamic of having these three, because isn't that what we like about Star Trek, is seeing especially groups of characters all bantering with one another, and to have three characters on Voyager all kind of, especially like younger characters who have that kind of youthful energy hanging out together and just kind of playing with one another. I think that would have been really fun.
Who else had youthful energy on Star Trek Voyager? Would it have to have been Kes?
Yeah, Kes definitely did.
You know, and then Neelix would have been jealous because he wasn't part of the young crew.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I guess, I guess
Naomi.
I was going to say Naomi Ichab. Wildman had plenty of youthful energy. Ichab had no youthful, energy whatsoever. He was youthful, but he had no energy.
Q2, we could have gotten,
oh my God.
Keegan DeLancey,
moving on.
Okay. Well, moving on to Star Trek Enterprise.
Yeah.
You know, okay, so I know I was saying like I was veering more towards like regular cast members,
mm-hmm.
but there is this one episode with two recurring stars that I thought there's so much energy and chemistry between both Saval and Shran in Kirshara. This is the one Shran has to abduct and then torture Saval and get the information out of him. And it's just amazing how as much as Shran is trying to extract this information, he also kind of is trying to extract some emotion from him, but Shran is incredibly reluctant to do this. He keeps saying, it gives me no pleasure to do this.
Right.
Saval's throwing it back at him, though. And I think these two actors, Gary Graham and Jeffrey Combs, have this great chemistry. I would have loved to see even more of this, because there was hints of this in previous episodes where these two guys kind of get a little bit combatant with each other. If we had that hypothetical season 5 of Enterprise where mm-hmm. Shran would have been like a main character, I can only imagine all the more, you know, Saval interactions that would have occurred from there.
Saval is kind of, in a way, like Tuvok, too, in that, you know, when presented kind of clunkily, he comes across as very unlikable and kind of bland. And I agree the show did a better job at presenting that character in ways that you could actually find him entertaining and watchable and actually kind of likable. And I think, yeah, when you have these two paired off, it's first off, two really strong actors bouncing off one another. But
how much can they bench?
It's like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lou Ferrigno.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. But no, I think, you know, when you see these two actors bouncing off each other here in Kirshara, you really get a sense that, like, boy, they could do a lot more with these two. Like, there is a combative nature to them. Saval too often is presented as just kind of a stiff character. And I think when you have a character like Shran, who's much more antagonistic, you would actually get more reaction out of Saval when you have these two in a scene together.
Well, for me, like, Saval didn't really click until season 4.
Yeah.
And there's this one moment.
I really disliked him for quite a while when I started watching the series.
Which I think was the function of the character.
Yeah, that's not a great function to have for your character, though.
No, it's
unless
tough.
You're an actual villain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
but even
tough.
Then, you want to be, you know, like more like the audience loves to hate you. You don't want to be just hated.
But what can you really do as an actor with, you know, a species that's not supposed to have any visible emotions?
Right.
Which brings me to one of my favorite Saval moments where, you know, they comment on how...
I thought it was going to be Gary Graham playing, like, rock guitar at the convention this year.
One of my most delightful moments, celebrity encounters at this year's Star Trek 2018 Las Vegas convention was when late at night we encountered Gary Graham by the elevators. And
right.
I said, hey... It's been great having you entertain me for this past week. And he said, who are you? No, I didn't. No, but you know, when I think it was Mayweather. Mayweather really didn't get much to do on the show. But I think Mayweather said, well, didn't really seem as if you like humans that much. And Saval was like, well, thank you. You know, like
right.
he has been disguising this. Like, even though he made it clear that, you know, I would not be ambassador to Earth if I did not find anything worthy of this particular... you know, posting here.
Right.
And I thought that was actually really interesting. It made me kind of rethink the character. Like, yes, he must have some sort of affection for mm-hmm. this planet that he's posted on, even if he's not going to reveal it, and even if he's quite paternal to a very, I don't know, mansplaining sort of degree for
right.
most of the cast. But I would have loved more Saval and Shran on the series.
No, I think that it's actually a really good option. And of course, obviously, you always want more Shran.
Yes.
Frankly, Shran paired with anyone would be desirable, I think.
Who would have been a bad Shran pairing?
Oh, that is an excellent question. I mean,
Porthos?
Shran Porthos. He would just keep giving him cheese.
Yeah.
I question whether they would have been able to make an interesting pairing of Mayweather and Shran. Just because Mayweather is a character who is written so vaguely that I just don't know that there's any sort of...
defining characteristics that
I have a really hard time
conflict over.
Well, exactly. I have a hard time even wrapping my head around how a Mayweather character would react, because I'm really not clear on that character at all. which is very unfortunate because I think Anthony Montgomery has a ton of charisma.
Okay.
It's not the actor. It's the writer.
I was but near 7 feet away from him in Las Vegas this year when he was doing karaoke singing Friends in Low Places.
Right.
And it was quite delightful.
Yeah.
He was giving it all he had. So I totally agree. Great actor.
He was also doing the Humpty Hump rap, which was amazing as well.
How did it go?
I don't even remember. I don't remember the words to that one at all. I just know the song.
Okay.
Like, vaguely, because it was very popular for a very short burst of time.
Fair enough. Okay.
Okay, well, the one that actually inspired this entire podcast topic for me was, first off, you know, I've been doing my rewatch of Enterprise, and it becomes very clear in, you know, I think I'm like 20 episodes into season one, that Hoshi is intended to be a character that we care about and is, to a certain degree, like our eyes on the ship. Like, she's the character who's nervous to be there.
Yeah.
She's the most human character. And, you know, initially I was like, boy, I really love her and Phlox together. Like, I really would have liked to have seen them in at least a couple episodes where those two are the A story. But what I really latched onto that I think worked really well was the pairing in the episode Sleeping Dogs, which, for people who don't remember, it's where they...
Wait, can I guess?
Yeah, go ahead.
Does this have to do with, like, Klingons?
It does, yeah.
It's one of the most forgettable Enterprise episodes.
Yeah, it's not
ever.
A great episode, but yeah. It's like there's a derelict, or so they think, Klingon ship that's in a gas giant. They go down, and there's actual Klingons still there, and it kind of causes havoc. But we get this pairing of Hoshi and T'Pol. And Hoshi is expressing to T'Pol, you know, that she's very, like, intimidated by T'Pol and wishes she could be more like her. And T'Pol ends up talking her through, like, meditation techniques to help her get through this crisis situation. And after this episode, I went online because I was curious if other people talked about this relationship. This is where I was really wondering if, like, is this a good podcast topic? And people were really talking about how they really were hoping at that point to see maybe, like, a mentor relationship between T'Pol and Hoshi. Because T'Pol, at this point in the series, is being iced a lot by Archer and Trip
right.
and all these sort of characters. They're yeah. kind of like...
What's the old boys club that they had going
definitely
on
definitely a boys yeah. club. Even Reed's kind of included in that. But T'Pol's kind of this loner character at this point. And I think it would have been a really interesting pairing is to have the most sealed off character bonding with the most human character.
Right.
And even giving guidance to this human character in a way, because we see that the Vulcans were the overseers of kind of humanity. They were the ones keeping them back, essentially, which they're constantly blamed for. Pretty much every 15 minutes on Enterprise.
That's why I was bringing up Saval just moments ago, man.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea that she would then be mentoring Hoshi and helping Hoshi grow would actually be a really good payoff to the relationship the Vulcans have with humans.
Right.
And you know what they end up doing? Just a couple episodes later, we get to the episode Vox Sola, which is the one where that, like, web-like creature takes over and starts sucking people into its web on the ship. And they pair these two characters off again. And I was like, oh, awesome. And what does it turn into? Like, Hoshi, like, mad at T'Pol and sniping at her because she thinks that T'Pol's being condescending to her as a boss.
Don't forget Inamir Darkly, where the mirror universe versions sure. of each other. And excuse my French, but T'Pol engages in a bit of slut-shaming with regards to Hoshi.
Definitely, yeah.
And it's like, this is really not how you support your fellow female crew members.
T'Pol has a bit of a history of that, as I've been relearning watching season one of Enterprise. But, you know, in the Voxala thing, like, I don't really like how it's just Hoshi being, like, snipey at her until T'Pol finally says, like, look, you're very good at your job and I just have high expectations.
Sure.
That, you know, the scenes are a little uncomfortable and I think it kind of plays on some bad stereotypes about, like, you know, a woman in authority is going to, you know, the woman below them aren't going to get along, which is not really something I think that's great to do on Star Trek when you have only two female characters on your show.
And it's not like this is a script from, like, 1974.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it feels very just, like, backwards thinking.
Especially in, like, say, 2003.
Yes. But you know what? I would be okay with it if it was, like, they got over this hurdle in this episode and Hoshi had a way of reframing the relationship and it built from that.
Yeah.
But it never builds from there. So you're kind of like, okay, well, I guess they're cool now.
How much do you think that is that they just really didn't want to explore, say, characters like Hoshi or Mayweather that much?
I think there was a fundamental problem in the Hoshi character initially in that they created a character who is like our audience identification character, but who's terrified to be in space.
Yeah.
How many episodes can you keep that going?
Before it's just kind of very derivative.
Or you're just saying, why is this character in space?
Yeah, it's been a year already.
Yeah.
And maybe that was it. They're like, okay, well, it's been a year already. She's adjusted to space.
It's kind of like the Janice Rand problem, where they create this character who has a really interesting purpose, but you're like, how long can we prolong this? Because we would see shortly after Hoshi really gets backgrounded. But you can tell early on in the series, like, she wasn't going to be the star of the show, but she was going to be a character who had
more
to
Scott do. Bakula. You've been replaced.
It was actually Hoshi who had the water polo thing, and they ended up swapping it over to Bakula.
Actually, I just want to recount this story from the Vegas convention, though. But, Cam, do you remember we were at that panel, One Trek Mind, in which we were debating who are the best mirror universe characters? And we had a lot of people in the crowd, like, making a very strong case for Mirror Empress Hoshi here. To the point where, like, multiple people in the crowd, myself included, engaged in, like, a 60-second-long chant of, Hoshi, Hoshi. I don't think Linda Parks ever would have experienced that at a convention, you know, which...
And like, it was long. Like, he's not really exaggerating to say 60 seconds. It was long to the point where the host, Jordan Hoffman, just had this, like, perplexed expression on his face of, like, almost like, and I could totally put myself in his place... If you were on stage, like, you'd be like, I've lost control of this panel. Like, I don't know where this is going. And he definitely had that look on his face of like, are these guys just going to overtake this entire panel?
That was a really fun panel, though.
It was. Like,
we had
great.
A blast. Didn't Hoshi outrank Mir Spock by the end?
Who did she lose? She lost to Georgiou, Emperor Georgiou.
Which I think we're all kind of scratching our heads. Cause,
recency bias.
But I'm just going... At the fact that I think if you give Linda Park great stuff, she actually like was doing really well on this series, and it's just kind of disappointing that they didn't really keep up the pace with her.
And this character is really likable and relatable. Like a lot of the Star Trek characters, especially like when you're looking at say like TNG, they feel or Voyager, a lot of them feel very like stiff. And even like the younger characters, you're like, boy, they feel far more professional than I am, and I'm older than they are.
Yeah, that's true.
Whereas like Hoshi actually has those sort of rough around the edges sort of sense to her where you can really relate to that character and understand completely where she's coming from. Whereas like when I'm watching Trip talk about pecan pie, I'm like, I do not know who this man is.
No.
And I have never been this man.
Fair enough. Cam, why don't we go over to Star Trek Discovery and tell me about like, it's only been 15 episodes. So,
right.
You know, there's a lot of potential here, but tell me about like maybe a relationship that you say so far, I mean, underexplored, but maybe there's potential for us to explore in season too, because it's very early on in the series run.
Right. This one was actually really easy for me.
I hope you didn't take mine then.
I might have. My favorite episode of the season was Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad.
Yeah.
And I think one of my favorite scenes in all of Discovery so far was when Stamets is talking to Burnham about how she's never been in love. And like there is real like sensitivity. There's emotion in that moment. It doesn't have any of the aloofness that Star Trek often has when it's looking at human romantic relationships. Like, their talk feels very authentic and real.
Anything from Star Trek The Next Generation when it comes to passion
it's
and love.
So brutal.
I'm like, okay. Or what about Harry Kim and the disease?
Oh, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I'm thinking of when I think of these Star Trek romantic relationships.
Yeah.
Or it's more of like... And I'm not necessarily saying this in a disparaging way, but it's more like your kind of sitcom/rom-com style of thing where like you have the Tom Bolana like bickering in space that kind of turns into like a romance like
Miles and Keiko who apparently hate each other's guts.
Sure. Yeah. Like I think those relationships work for their shows, but they are much more of like an artificial television approach to that sort of storytelling. Whereas like in this Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, like I really love this dynamic of Stamets and Burnham, and I like that these two. And, like, look, Stamets is a character we've seen in previous episodes is pretty chilly. And I like that he opens up to Burnham. And I really think he's compelling delivering this dialogue. I think Anthony Rapp is great in this scene. And it was such a great scene that it really filled me with hope that I was going to see more of this sort of thing. Like, this sort of relationship continue between these two characters. And, like, they do have screen time together. Like, Burnham, when you look at her on paper, she does pair off with a lot of characters a lot. Like, you can't feel like she's robbed of time with certain characters. But I do feel like this one hasn't been exploited to its fullest, whereas I think we've seen the others they've really put a lot of energy into, whether it's Tilly or Ash Tyler, like, or even Lorca. Like, those characters got a lot of time with Burnham, whereas I really want to see Stamets nailed down a little more just as to who he is as a person and his relationship with Burnham.
Well, I think we're still kind of very confused what kind of character Stamets is right now.
Yeah.
Because, like, his character changed fundamentally halfway through in the episode you mentioned, Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, in which he went from, like, this very, as you said, aloof, chilly sort of character.
Almost like a Geordi character.
Yeah. But like, a really harsh Geordi.
Yeah. More like Geordi when he's mad, like, when he's with Barkley.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. And then he turns into, like, kind of this mycelium network loving sort of groovy man.
Surfer dude, yeah.
Yeah. And
he's like Jeff Bridges in Tron Legacy.
Sure, sure. I'd love for him to get into his emptied cabin now that his partner's gone and be like, yeah. Hey, I need a new rug.
Right.
It's really going to tie the room together.
What was that term he used in Tron Legacy that everyone laughed about? Like, bio something jazz?
I literally remember almost nothing from that.
I know. It was like biotechnological jazz or something.
Okay.
Oh.
I remember watching Jeff Bridges' character on screen and just, like, giggling because of, like, how young they tried to make him look.
Right,
and,
yeah.
You know, you're not quite up there with Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer in Ant-Man 2 just yet
right.
at that point cinema.
There's only two actors really having fun in that movie, though.
Yeah.
And it's Jeff Bridges and Michael Sheen.
I agree.
Yeah.
Michael Sheen. What about Daft Punk?
I mean, sure.
Okay. Anyways, yeah, but Stamets, it's like we're still trying to grasp what he's going to be like. And remember, even the Mirror Universe, like he was still like in a coma for mm-hmm. that arc. So we were hanging out with Mirror Stamets.
Yeah.
Who seemed to be kind of like a third iteration, like a lot less sure of himself as well.
Yeah.
So our exposure to Stamets has been all over the place in season one.
Right.
And I have to say, I favor Stamets from the first, well, I guess episodes 3 through 6.
Yeah.
So it's a very small slice of Stamets that I really, really dig. And I just wonder where they go from here, especially after he's going to be recovering from the loss of his partner, you'd hope.
Well,
although in what, episode 14, he kind of was like still just like, oh yeah, well, there you go. Which is like kind of disturbing.
Right.
You know.
Well, I mean, I'm very curious to see what happens with that, because Wilson Cruz is returning for season 2.
That's what the actor, at least, is claiming.
Yes.
So, but you know what? One, Kenneth Mitchell, he says that he's returning.
Yeah.
He played Cole.
Right.
But he didn't actually say that Cole is returning.
Right.
So we'll wait on that.
Yeah.
So who knows? Anyways.
We'll have Kenneth Mitchell news in future episodes.
Yeah, I know everyone's, you know. But, you know, for me, why don't we keep this going here? Because Stamets is on my list as well. The Stamets-Tilly stuff.
Right.
I find it fascinating because, like, they seem just on kind of the other side of the spectrum. Essentially, like Stamets is kind of the jerky sort of dude, and Tilly's very insecure, don't know what to do with myself. Could you ever imagine, like, Tilly snapping at Lorca the way that Stamets did?
No.
Or even think about the Saru moment in Choose Your Pain, where Stamets is just disregarding what Saru's orders were.
Right.
And you would never have that moment, between Tilly and any other commanding officer.
Right.
You know, that said, I also have to throw out the fact that these are the first two characters to ever share an F-bomb.
Sure.
On Star Trek.
They're also the two biggest science geeks on the show as well.
Well, I like that because I think going into season 2, you've got that cool dynamic where Tilly's now officially an ensign. She's in engineering. Stamets is kind of the science guy. So I like that kind of like that. So in engineering, you've got like the engineer who kind of designs sorts of things based on the theories that like scientists are putting forth. So I kind of like the idea of maybe Stamets coming up with like wacky ideas and it's up to Tilly to realize them or figure out how they're actually going to go. I think there's a lot of potential for these two characters going forward as well.
I think yours has a lot more likelihood to really develop into something. I think that the showrunners realized that those two really worked and were fun together. Whereas I don't know that they're looking at Burnham and Stamets being like, boy, we got to do more there.
Yeah, you know.
Burnham already has a pretty full plate with Ash Tyler and Saru. And, you know, I'm sure she'll be paired opposite Pike a lot.
Yes.
And so I do feel like Stamets will probably get backburnered to a certain degree.
Backburnhamed?
But, you know, and of course her and Tilly are going to be a duo as well a lot on the show. So.
Yeah.
You know, I do think yours has a really good shot at happening because, I mean, Stamets is going to be a regular again in season 2. We, you know, have no spoilers indicating anything else. And so you do wonder, like, how they're going to use him. you hope when you're looking at a cast that you can figure out what these characters might contribute to a season. I feel better about Discovery in that regard than I would had I been watching some of the other series in the past. Like, I can't say if I were tuning in for season 3 Enterprise, I'd be like, I think they've really figured out Mayweather this season.
Or that Argyle, he's really got a lot to
Argyle
do in season 2.
Argyle is going to explode in season 2. Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, Kim, why don't we do a bit of a lightning round and go through some, like, hypothetical, like, relationships that were just, A, like, kind of weren't explored at all, and then B, maybe kind of ideas about why they would work. But we'll do it much quicker than we did originally.
These are kind of a little more out there ones, I think, to a certain, at least some of mine are.
Yeah, okay. Here's my first one. Arium and anyone.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Arium is a character I love. I think she's so cool looking.
But I don't know why.
Yeah.
Like, she's awesome, but I don't know why.
She is the Boba Fett of this franchise, where she doesn't really contribute much other than a couple lines of dialogue, but everyone's like, who is that?
She looks so badass.
Yeah.
She's got this killer voice. It's like, she's like a lieutenant commander, so she would be like, well, it's very confusing now because Burnham is now a full commander. I don't really know how the rankings are at
point,
but I think she was second in command after Saru. So there's so much potential for this character. I'll say this. I would like to see her paired up with Saru, and they can, I don't know, he can munch blueberries while she, I don't know, fills up her oil or something.
Right.
She is like a cybernetic being. I guess that's what we've been told, but I'm still fascinated by Arium. So I'll pitch the Arium-Saru relationship for season 2.
Okay.
What about you, Cameron?
Okay, well, there's one that it's almost like I don't want it, but I think it would have helped the series, and that is more Chakotay 7.
Okay.
Because they have this romantic relationship at the end of the series, and it feels so weird and wrong.
And out of nowhere.
And out of nowhere. Yeah. Whereas I think if you'd actually had maybe some episodes leading up to that, you wouldn't have been so uncomfortable sitting through them.
What about the Nog and Sisko potential there? Because we see in an episode like Heart of Stone, where Nog explains why he wants to join Starfleet. His father's kind of a failure at being in a Ferengi. Although his father does become Grand Nagus within a few years. But I really like the dynamic between those two actors. And beyond Nog just reciting a little bit of exposition at the helm of the Defiant, they didn't really have all that much to do. Even though, you know, like early on, like Sisko was not super happy about Jake hanging out with Nog.
Right.
And I think there's so much more potential for, like, you know, how intimidated is Nog of Sisko pre-Starfleet versus post-Starfleet?
I
think that would have been a fun dynamic to explore.
You get little bits of really rich material and, like, it's only a paper moon and the siege of AR. You always know the number.
AR-558.
Thank you. Or even when Nog is going to him about applying to Starfleet. Like, you do get these really great moments, but it feels like you could have built an episode around this.
Yeah.
And it would have been a really good episode. So, no, I'm totally down for that. You know, speaking of Ferengi, this is one I think, I don't know if it would have been good, but boy, would it have been memorable if they'd have done an episode pairing Grand Nagus Zak against Gowron.
Okay.
Two leaders
yeah.
in a debate of some sort. Like, watching Wallace Shawn try to out-act Robert O'Reilly would have been among the most amazing things I can ever imagine.
Okay, yeah, I could imagine them both on the promenade. There's like a big crowd, and there's a lot of back and forth between them, trying to get everyone to cheer loudest. You know, I would have eaten that all up.
In any world, like, would this have been good?
Yes.
Or would it have been just so hammy that it would have broken the universe of Star Trek?
It would have been hammy, but in a hammy sort of way that I love.
Right.
So I would have been down for that.
Okay.
For me, I this is just such a weird pairing that I had to share it. But, like, what if Neelix and Chakotay had to do a Captain Proton, like, holodeck episode?
Well, that's an interesting point about Neelix, because he's a character who does feel very stranded once Kes leaves the show.
Yeah.
And he's paired off with Naomi Wildman. And then, you know, occasionally we see him with Tuvok in episodes that just don't work. And Chakotay as well. Chakotay does not really have that many interesting relationships.
Quite a
bit. It's like two characters you might as well. Like, I can't say that when I hear those two names, I'm like, yeah, that could have been fun.
Yeah.
But I'm like, you might as well have rolled the dice.
That's what my thought process is. Like, put them in, like, the wackiest sort of setting possible in Voyager at Captain Proton.
Yeah.
And see what these actors would have done with each other.
Do they have any common ground to explore?
Well, that's just it. Maybe not. Maybe that's what actually makes it interesting, though.
I mean, I guess you could go into Neelix's backstory and that, like, a lot of his family and, you know, his species was wiped out, and the Maquis were definitely a small number, so they're both kind of survivors.
They find out that the Maquis are wiped out completely by, I think, season six.
Yeah.
So
you could have these two survivors and reflecting on that. The only problem
that doesn't sound a lot of fun, like a lot of fun.
I thought this was a comedy episode. Yeah. I mean, the only problem I think is that by the time you get to season six, they are not interested in developing Neelix as a dramatic character.
No.
He's more of just like a kind of a comedic character.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't think they were going to do that. And just for me, lastly, this is just, you know, I think anyone who listened to the podcast knows this one's probably going to come up. And this is a pairing, I think, that would have been legendary for Subspace Transmissions, the podcast.
Okay.
And that is a Beryl Shakar pair-up episode.
Wow. Where you have... You're already relieving my insomnia.
Because what happens when you pair a man of peace and a man who was a warrior together?
I guess you'd have the cure for insomnia. Those two.
Which one out-acts the other?
Out-acts. I would say, just based on mere Beryl...
Yeah,
I guess
give Philip Anglim.
Philip Anglim.
Okay,
that's my best guess.
Yeah,
it would be such a horrible sort of like slog.
Yeah,
for a full episode of those two paired off.
I was thinking more of an arc.
Okay, yeah. Listen to them debate Bajoran politics. That would have been just fantastic.
Okay. So on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Kim, obviously we were in Star Trek Las Vegas 2018, where Patrick Stewart came out on stage and announced that there's going to be a big spin-off series featuring one Picard. And we've touched on this a little bit in our recap episode of Vegas. We also talked about the rumors of the spinoff series a few weeks back.
Spoiler, the rumors have been true.
They've been true the whole time, which what we want to do next week, though, is I think take a deeper dive and just kind of answer the question, why is Picard so important to Star Trek? So we're going to be answering that question. We're also going to approach the episode in a bit of a different way, explore, I guess, some episodes that I think the current writers could look towards, and they're not going to be the super obvious ones, you know, where it's like, oh yeah,
the inner light,
yeah. Sure, you know, these are going to be like moments, character beats, like stuff that really works for Picard and really explains who he is,
and maybe some stuff that's been kind of forgotten.
Yeah, I agree. And so this is, for me so far, it's been fun to research this, rewatch some episodes that I'm like, yes, you know, Picard is on fire here.
You've just been watching Captain's Holiday on a loop.
Oh, that's pretty much like, yeah, I don't see an issue with that.
Yeah.
So, and Cupid.
Right.
Yeah. I wish that is the entire season one of the Picard spinoff. Well, is they're in Sherwood Forest.
Patrick Stewart did say it would be very, very different than what people were expecting.
That would be amazing. Okay. Okay. So, yeah, tune in. We're going to take a deep dive into, I think, what a lot of fans have been wondering, you know, like, what does Picard mean for the franchise and why this is so important that they are going to be doing this Picard spinoff moving forward. And, you know, it is even fascinating how Patrick Stewart admitted to everybody at the convention, like, we don't have any scripts, but right, I'm still signed up. So I think we still have a lot of leeway to kind of consider and explore what this means moving forward.
For sure. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. You can find me at Cam, V as in Vox Sola, killed the Hoshi to Paul relationship, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-A-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Negus, V, Chancellor.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.